can do. So I'll speak up. If anyone can't hear, just shout, and I can try and speak louder. So welcome to this summer school lunchtime lecture. I'm very delighted to have with us Dr. Craig Gallagher from the Human Rights Commission. And before I ask him to speak, I'm going to tell you a bit about her. But as you can see, she's been very kind to come out to the lecture, even with her leg on crutches and her leg in a cast. So we're even more grateful to her. And you'll obviously allow her to sit because it's not friendly to walk around with crutches while you're speaking. And I'll also help her at the end with her questions so that we can take some questions at the end. Okay, so as I said, Dr. Gallagher is currently working as chair of the South African Human Rights Commission. She was appointed a commission at the end of 2008. And she was unanimously appointed by Parliament. That's despite the fact that she resigned in 2002. Following, I'm sure you all may be aware of this and followed her in the press, her opposition to the arms deal and her insistence of raising the HIV AIDS issue under the time of President Mbeki's government. Craig's was part of the first democratic government in 1994 when Mandela came into power. She served as an ANC MP in his government and was very important in pioneering the lobbying for the rights of women and initiated the whole concept of budgeting around gender issues, so looking at the economy from a gender perspective. Is very well known in her time as an anti-apartheid activist. She, in the 70s, in Durban, where she grew up, she was involved with student, women, community and political organizations who were opposing apartheid. And certainly when I was a young person, she was at the time, at the St. Thomas Prick, she was a very well-known figure in the anti-apartheid circles. After completing her studies at university, she taught for a while at schools and then later at university before moving into the trade union movement, where she still remained interested in education and got involved in worker education. Then, during the transition to democracy, that's in the 90s, she was involved in the Women's National Coalition, and which was responsible for drawing up the Women's Charter for South Africa and lobbying for the inclusion of women's rights in the new constitution. And I think we all know that our constitution has got quite exceptional respect for women's rights. So I think it's partly part of Craig's work that's going to be found in that. She still serves on the international panel on human dignity, and she's received many awards for her work, including an honorary doctorate in law and philosophy, the Ruth First Fellowship, and a Fulbright scholarship around her work with women's rights. In 2007, she published a book called Love and Courage, A Story of Insubordination. And I think it's been acclaimed as a very courageous and important piece of work. I think one of the quotes was speaking the truth about important issues in our society. So I think we're very grateful to have someone like her as part of our society in South Africa. She was telling me that she's recently been appointed as a pioneer for a new program that the Nelson Mandela Foundation set up. It's trying to take forward some of the ideas and values that Mandela has pioneered and are based on some of the ideas in his recent book, Conversations with Mandela. So she can tell you more about it if you're interested in the question time. But she's a pioneer of something called the Champion Within. It's a new program which they'll be launching. I think it's probably aimed at the youth, I imagine, as well. That's the general population. So if you're interested in that, you can ask a bit more about it. But she's going to talk on this very important topic of love and revolution, and I think she has epitomizes that. So very welcome to have you here, Briggs.
Thank you very much to all of you for taking the time to come here today. Yesterday was the 50th anniversary of a tragic assassination of one of Africa's foremost revolutionaries, Patrice Lumumba. And I would like to begin by asking all of you just to take a moment in silence, in respect and in recognition of him. I thought for those who, just to remind you of who he was, he was the first democratically elected prime minister of the Congo, whom the British, Americans, Belgians, and South Africans had jointly conspired to murder. Lumumba was a man of vision, values, and principled commitment to the poor. In his place, they installed Mobutu, a man of greed who protected their mining interests. If we could take a moment in silence, in recognition and in respect for what it is that he gave to not just the Congo, but to Africa and to the world. Thank you. South Africa's constitution, under the founding provisions, the Republic of South Africa is one sovereign democratic state founded on the following values. And the very first value is human dignity. In the Bill of Rights, human dignity in section 10 states that everyone has inherent dignity and the right to have their dignity respected and protected. I've been acting as chair for the Human Rights Commission for the last few days, and we've been looking at what it is and how it is that we celebrate Human Rights Day this year, what it is that we commemorate on Human Rights Day this year. And we've been looking at the issue of the right to water and sanitation. The right to dignity was upheld in a court case following a complaint that the Commission had ruled on in terms of a community not too far from here, in Makaza, in Khayelitsha. Can I speak louder? Certainly. Okay, can I? Very loud. Okay. I'm not used to sitting and talking and addressing a meeting, so I'm going to have to make a few adjustments along the way, so if you'd bear with me. Can you all hear me now? Okay, the court case reaffirmed the court finding, reaffirmed the Commission's finding that building toilets without enclosing them constituted a violation of the right to dignity. The Commission in its finding found that and recommended that the municipality of Cape Town, the city of Cape Town, had to ensure that those toilets were enclosed. But much more than that, we also recommended that the department, the National Department of Human Settlements, had to address the issue of the eradication of the bucket system throughout South Africa. There was a similar finding that we made in the Free State, where we found again against the municipality in the Free State. And we made another finding, not just in relation to the municipality, but in relation to national government. And in that finding, we said very clearly that national government had to study what was happening in every single municipality across South Africa and tell us what was happening with the right to sanitation in every single municipality across the country. But we wanted, in addition to that, to know what is the plan to address the right to sanitation, to water and sanitation, and what is the budget and implementation plan to be able to ensure that. Why am I talking about toilets in an introduction to a talk on revolution and love? because I don't think you can get any more basic than that. And I think that the implications, I think particularly for all the women in the room, there's particular implications, gendered implications, when there isn't the right to adequate sanitation, when there isn't the right to adequate water. There's I brought along a pamphlet that I'd taken from a meeting with the independent expert, the United Nations independent expert, on the human rights obligations related to access to safe drinking water and sanitation. That's the pamphlet. In the pamphlet, she notes that overall, household water use accounts for less than 10% of total water use, while industry and agriculture are the largest water users. Those of you who are environmentalists will know the implications then for climate change in terms of who is using the 90% of water, and what are they doing with that 90% of water, and what is the implications for people, particularly people who are poor, and the planet. So the question is accountability, not just on the 10% of water, but on the 90% of water. I wanted to, if we're talking about the issue of how do you change, what is it that we're facing in terms of revolutions across the world? At the end of last year, I addressed a gathering of activists from North Africa and the Middle East. And I addressed it via video, because obviously I couldn't travel. But they were interested in looking at what are the lessons from South Africa for their countries and for their revolutions. Many of them were are deeply committed to nonviolence as a strategy. And across the world right now, from Egypt to the Wall Street protests, people are talking about the 1% versus the 99%. That there's 1% who own most of the wealth of the world. And what is mobilized to protect that wealth, what is mobilized to extract that wealth, is not a new story. It's an ancient story. What is mobilized is military might, it's greed, it's hate. What is also mobilized is the power of propaganda, the power to make us believe certain things about ourselves and each other. I thought in preparing this to try to get a sense of, well, if we're talking about love, what is the power we're up against? And I wanted to quote from the Kaiser's Holocaust, Germany's Forgotten Genocide. And it's an examination of what happened in Namibia. And I've forgotten my glasses. So
they make
The comforting fantasy, no, this is the long, this I need to shorten. When you're in your 50s, you start, the eyesight starts going. I'm sure many of you in the room sympathize with that. In referring to Nazi Germany and to the Nuremberg trials, the author says, their actions had shown them to be inhumane. Perhaps, therefore, they were unhuman. Led by such men, the Third Reich had been capable of crimes that were both terrible and unique in history. Nazism, so the argument went, had been an aberration in European history, a discontinuity. This is the great post-war myth, the comforting fantasy that the Nazis were a new order of monsters and that their crimes were without precursor or precedent. They were not. Much of Nazi ideology and many of the crimes committed in its name were part of a longer-term trend within European history. Nazism was both a culmination and a distortion of decades of German and European history and philosophy. It was, in part, the final homecoming of theories and practices that Europeans had developed and perfected in far-flung corners of the world during the last phase of imperial conquest. There is nothing within that historical subsoil that made the ultimate flowering of Nazism inevitable, but there is much that makes it understandable. The Herero and Nama genocides, along with the Nazi vision of race war and settlement in Eastern Europe, can both be seen as aspects of a larger phenomena, the emergence from Europe of a terrible strain of racial colonialism that viewed human history through the prism of a distorted form of social Darwinism and regarded the earth as a racial battlefield on which the weak, in quotation marks, were destined to be vanquished, unquote. How does love respond to that? One of the most interesting leaders in relation to nonviolent revolution has been Aung San Suu Kyi, who was released in 2010. Finally, after many, many years under house arrest and in detention. In the last while, she's raised an important challenge. And it's going to be a challenge in terms of how it is that the rest of the world stands in solidarity with her movement and with her belief in nonviolence. In one of her letters from Burma, Suu had argued that it was not yet time to invest, unquote. She made a much more wide-ranging attack on foreign investment, condemning a recent visit by a British trade delegation. And I'd like to quote what she says. It's not right for the British government to do it all it can to support human rights here and then to promote trade with Burma against democracy. The sort of involvement being suggested won't help to bring about sustained economic and social development. Suu's insight was that under this regime, economic liberalization could not be expected to produce any significant degree of freedom or democracy, or even more generalized affluence. Ruling government, SLOC's most significant reform was to allow foreign companies to invest in Burma, but from the outset they ensured that all the investment was done through them personally or through cronies in their control. Unquote. Of course, one of our erstwhile golf players. Somebody help me. Player? His name was Player?
Gary.
Gary Player? Built a golf course there on which the generals play. Ignoring the call that Aung San Suu Kyi has made. So what is nonviolent resistance about? Is it about some cute, cuddly, fuzzy, nice thing where we're all sweet to each other and never say anything unpleasant, challenging, discomforting? I'd like to take three quotes from Madiba from Love and Courage. The first is a letter from Robben Island to his wife Winnie when she was imprisoned yet again by the apartheid state, in which he shares the practice he developed in prison to keep his heart and soul intact, advising regular daily meditation as a way of learning to know oneself. He stressed the importance in personal growth of nurturing qualities like honesty, sincerity, simplicity, humility, generosity, and readiness to serve humanity. And quote, qualities within the reach of every soul. Never forget that a saint is a sinner that keeps on trying. In his letter, Madiba does not mention God or religion, but talks of spirituality. His words reinforced my understanding of spirituality as the practice of evoking the best in the human spirit so as to fully appreciate all of life. I do not like the language of God, entrapped within its very specific historical and cultural context. But I do appreciate the call, whoever makes it, to respect the love that resides within every human being when we ourselves may have completely lost sight of it. It is this recognition that characterizes encounters with people like Madiba and many other people that we meet every day. Simply by being in their presence, I feel elevated, even when they have not said a word. As someone who struggles at times to remain connected to the joy within myself, it is a gift to encounter it in children or in someone who has mastered the practice. Gandhi has been one of the key thinkers that has been recognized globally in terms of his articulation and his practice of nonviolent resistance. He termed what has been called nonviolent resistance satyagraha, and I'd just like to read a little bit about him from Love and Courage. Brought to South Africa by Indian businessmen to protect their interests initially, Gandhi expressed prejudice against Africans and indentured laborers, who formed the majority of Indians. It was South Africans, like 15-year-old Veliamma Mudlier, who literally died because of the courage of her convictions, that helped inspire and shape Satyagraha as, and I quote, the force born out of truth, love, and non-violence. I'd like to, in terms of trying to understand what is the use of the power of love and how does one actually engage it in terms of nonviolent resistance, and then in terms of once the revolution is over, what happens. And I know that in South Africa, we had a peaceful, negotiated transition. But I'd like to just refer to Madiba's humanity. When he was released from Robben Island, He insisted on speaking only the best of de Klerk, despite the fact that de Klerk had presided over terrible state-driven violence in apartheid's last years. Madiba's hurt and anger at de Klerk's betrayal of trust with the Boipatong massacre was palpable. Madiba had battled with the spiritual imperative of love that looks for the highest potential in every human being. He had elevated de Klerk to a Nobel Prize winner and had been met in Boipatong by cynical realpolitik. And then I'd like to quote what he says during the HIV/AIDS debacle in our country. If 27 years in prison have done anything to us, it is to use the silence of solitude to make us understand how precious words are and how real speech is in its impact upon the way people live and die. The poor on our continent would, if anyone cared to ask their opinions, wish that the dispute about the primacy of politics or science be put on the back burner and that we proceed to address the needs and concerns of those suffering and dying. Unquote. Non-violence has been used as a strategy in many peaceful revolutions across the world. Many of those are not documented to the extent that people understand it in the everyday. There is a story in the Kaiser's Holocaust about one of the first, the case that most deeply damaged Herero relations with the Germans took place in the middle of 1903. Barmenius Zeroa, the son of Herero chief Zacharias Zeroa, later recounted the events that led to the death of his wife. In 1903, my wife was expecting her first baby, so in accordance with the universal custom of the Hereros, I sent her by ox wagon to her mother's home. Before leaving Omaruru, we met a German named Dietrich, who asked me whether he would be allowed to travel with us in my wagon to Karabib. I said I had no objection, so Dietrich came along with us. That evening we outspanned about 12 miles along the main road. We killed a sheep and had our evening meal, which Dietrich shared with us. We gave him the fried sheep liver to eat, a delicacy. Then two boys went to attend to the cattle and my wife went into the hood of the wagon with her baby to sleep. The practice of sharing, the practice of believing, and it's something that the First Nations peoples across the world did believe, was that the earth belonged to all of us. That we hold the water, the land, the air we breathe in sacred trust. It's a very different belief system to a belief system premised on private property and ownership. It's a very different belief system to the one which has resulted in the 1% versus the 99%. He shared his food. He gave the best of the meal. And the result? I said goodnight to Dietrich and went to sleep. Suddenly I was awakened by the report of a revolver. I jumped out of the tent of the wagon and saw Dietrich running away on the road. I went back to the wagon. The baby was crying. I shook my wife to wake her. As I touched her, I felt something wet. I struck a match and saw she was covered with blood and quite dead. I took up my baby and found that the bullet which killed my wife had gone through the fleshy part of its left leg just above the knee. In Myanmar, Burma, the Burmese Buddhists took to the streets a few years ago, hundreds of them, and many of them were mowed down. So is it possible to assert love and revolution in the face of military might? I'd like to end with a poem by Aung San Suu Kyi's favorite poet, Rabindranath Tagore. And this is somebody who has practiced nonviolence resistance, the heart of it, and the heart of it is love, throughout her detention, throughout her years of house arrest. Her favorite poem says, "With the thunder flame of pain, ignite thine own heart and let it burn alone." I'd like to ask you, as we end, to ignite, to take a moment in silence. And to ignite your own heart. And igniting your own heart is igniting the flame of love in your heart. And let it burn. And I'd like you to turn around to people next to you and look at them. And as you recognize your inherent dignity, your inherent self-worth that the Constitution says is a right and the first founding value, to recognize that dignity in the person next to you. If you could take a moment in silence and just do that. And respect and recognize the dignity inherent in the people around you. I'd like to stop there and open for any questions that you may have. Thank you very much. I'd like to take a few questions, and then I'd like to have this as a dialogue, because I think I've done my speaking, and I'd be happy to engage the questions as we go along, but people should feel free to also contribute to the dialogue. We're in a lunch hour, and a lunch hour cannot do justice to revolution and love. So I'm going to say that we start the dialogue now.
Yesterday, Jane Naidoo in the lunchtime talk said, we must act and change. You've asked us to ignite our hearts and do something. So it's quite difficult when you're an aging white woman in South Africa to know what must a God now do. Because I wanted to ask Mr. Naidoo yesterday, so tell me what to do. I said to you today about what to do. Because you can change within. So you come to a lecture like this, and you intrinsically you feel changed, and you are going to be better afterwards. But you said change, and he said do. It's quite. And some suggestions.
Thank you very much. Can I ask people to just identify themselves? Sorry, the gentleman at the back.
My name is Tom Brown Love. Tom Brown Love.
And?
Sheila.
Sheila? Oh, certainly. It's a very interesting question in relation to the toilets. If you give enclosed toilets, does it mean that you must also have curtains on houses? Is the municipality next going to, did I hear that right? Will the municipality next be required to put curtains on houses? Let me just quickly take each of you to, in your minds, just right now, just as you're sitting right now, to right here and now, in front of everyone. We bring a few potties, toilets, and we ask you, actually, you're not going to have a break now. You're going to actually go to the toilet here. Anybody who needs to go to the toilet will actually just sit right here and you can do your business right here. Okay? You're comfortable with that? You all feel fine with that? Anybody okay with that? Anybody okay with sitting right here in front of everyone and doing your business? Anyone who's happy with that?
Would outside and not inside, in the open air?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Open outside, or in front of everyone, outside in this building, outside the building. We have some toilets outside, and you all are expected to go to the toilet when people are walking past, etc. Who would feel okay with that? Is there anyone here who would feel okay with that? Sorry, I had one hand up. You'd feel okay with that?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
I find it more offensive to be in a small, enclosed, and smelly space than in an open space. But I have that experience in the desert, you know, that...
So in your home, do you have a toilet that you have to go to outside your home?
No, it's indoors.
Your home, in your own home, you have a toilet indoors. And your children, your grandchildren, I'm assuming, are expected to go to a toilet in your house or outside, in your home. Okay, anyone else who feels it's okay if we had a toilet outside that was not enclosed, that would be happy to use that toilet? As people pass to you, how do you feel, those of you who are saying definitely not, how do you feel to be expected to use a toilet outside?
Sorry. What about my dignity? What about my children, you see? Because maybe I am a leader, you see. If I do that thing in front of my people, the people will not respect me, you see. And what about my dignity? The children also, if they, the youngsters see me, I do that, they will tell them. Okay, that man is not a leader, he has no respect. And also you must respect also your neighbor. If I do that thing, I not respect my neighbor.
Thank you. Sorry, I didn't get your names. Your name is?
Okay, my name.
Oh, so that I can actually talk to you. That's why I'm asking people's names. So I can actually talk to you, just as you're talking to me. So we engage in a dialogue.
Okay. My name is Weli Lefalake. I come from Mosul Bay. Weli Lefalake.
Thanks very much, Weli.
Thank you.
And, sorry. A first name is also fine. If people feel anxious about giving their names, that's fine. But if you feel happy, I didn't think it would be offensive to anyone. Thanks, Angela.
If I had to use an outside toilet, you told me it was quite a big toilet outside, would I be allowed to find something to enclose with myself, to give myself privacy? Mm-hmm. Am I permitted to do that?
Oh, yeah. No, you're always permitted to do what you could do.
So
to actually...
enclose it
to create some kind of but I'm asking you a question in relation to, because I think dignity, the heart of dignity, is not just inherent self-respect. It's actually inherent respect of inherent dignity in every other person.
Yes.
So the question is, and it comes down to the reason I started with Patrice Lumumba, the reason I went to Aung San Suu Kyi's story about trade and Britain coming, saying we support you, but investing in a way that was actually opposing the sanctions that would put upon the pressure needed to bring about the kinds of change necessary, was that central to dignity, and dignity is located in our constitution under socioeconomic rights. It's not something that's just in the air. It's not something that's nice, that makes us feel good. It's something that's very related to things that are very solid, to socioeconomic rights. And it's very interesting. The revolutions in North Africa were not just about the dictators. It was about the systems, global systems, that upheld those dictators. People were fighting unemployment. The first person who set himself alight in North Africa was struggling with the issue of unemployment and about his dignity, about trying to find work in a world in which formal jobs have been destroyed, where casualization of work is increasing, where people move in search of jobs that are insecure and temporary. So the issue of, and to come back to the first question, Tom Proudlock, the issue of toilets. If you enclose toilets, is the municipality not then going to be expected to build houses with curtains? It's being put forward as a very serious question. So I'm going to answer it. It's a very serious question. We have a national budget. And then we have budgets at provincial and local level. We have an apartheid state that preceded our democracy, which consciously privileged a small minority of people at the expense of the majority of people. We had a truth and reconciliation process, which was one of the most generous processes about rebuilding our society, about reconciliation. A central part of that, that was not addressed at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, was one of the key questions around the kind of society we were left with in 1994. And I'd just like to read a little bit about that. When I joined Parliament through the Finance Committee, I learned how significant sections of white business had benefited from special access to and collaboration with the apartheid state. One example of this is that during apartheid, over half of the Department of Trade and Industry's budget went to subsidizing large white-owned companies through the, and I quote, General Export Incentive Subsidy Scheme, unquote. On the day of the budget, business would also host the finance minister to a special breakfast briefing on the budget. Business was accustomed to wining and dining apartheid MPs, treating them to overseas holidays and expensive gifts. In return, the old MP sorted out anything that obstructed the smooth functioning of business or did what was required to promote it. There was no code of conduct whereby MPs had to declare gifts, no conflict of interest was registered, and corruption was not investigated or charged. This was just the way things were done. Business assumed that after 1994 it would continue to operate as it had done in the past. When the TRC held its hearings into the role of business in apartheid South Africa, many felt angry that these players escaped scot-free despite having benefited from apartheid policy. Mine owners, for example, had not taken responsibility for the huge numbers of deaths from occupational accidents underground and diseases like HIV/AIDS. They had not done much to change the underground conditions that caused accidents, and they had not addressed changing the single-sex hostels that exacerbated the spread of HIV and AIDS. Those who were seriously injured or became too ill were sent back home where they died miserably poor. Like many other ANC MPs, I assumed that my party, now in power, would transform the situation so that the concerns were at the top of our agenda. Though the ANC did initiate anti-corruption legislation and put in place codes of conduct for MPs, transformation would not be as simple as I had assumed. It was the reason why, by 2001, when the arms deal came into effect in the defense budget vote, I was the only member of parliament to register opposition to it in the budget vote itself. Because I believe that the money of our country must be used to address the reconstruction of our country. And central to the reconstruction of our country is the dignity of all South Africans. And so toilets built without enclosures, toilets built without proper housing, you cannot have trade-offs. You cannot have trade-offs between toilets and houses. You cannot have trade-offs between water and toilets. You cannot have trade-offs between toilets and health. You cannot have trade-offs between toilets and education. That is what is meant by the indivisibility of rights. That is what is meant by the universality of rights. And I think the issue of how our budgets are allocated and what are the priorities is central to reinstating dignity across South Africa. It means that all of us have to look at how do we actually, and I'd like to quote again the poem of Aung San Suu Kyi's favorite poet. How do we, with a thunder flame of pain, ignite our own hearts and let it burn alone? How do we actually make sure that that informs how we see the dignity of each other and how we uphold that dignity? In this municipality, in this province, we spent billions of rands on a world-class stadium. We were able to build it overnight almost. I have been reading a report yesterday. It's around, it's from the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation. And it's about the study that we've asked them to do, which they will be releasing the full study by the end of February to us. In that study, it shows that in the initial figures, an estimated 10 million people have no access to adequate sanitation across water and sanitation across our country. How do you build a $1 million stadium? How do you buy? How do you spend billions of rands on submarines and other weapons of war from countries which know that post-apartheid the priority should be the reconstruction of South Africa? There was a hand up.
Don't worry. Don't respond to the
what to do? I think that's a question that each of us actually has to face on our own. I think we face it within the communities that we engage in, whether that's in our families, whether that's in our religious institutions, whether that's in sporting institutions, whether that's in women's organizations. There's a whole range of ways in which we interact, whether it's in read book clubs, whatever those different ways we engage in. What we need to identify, each of us, and it's not specific to being somebody who is white, who is an older woman, it's across all of us. It's identifying what is the power we have and how would we actually give effect to that power. So whether that's power in your own home, in relationship to your children, in relation to the people you employ in your home, in relation to your business and how you treat people in the business, it's in all of those different ways. There's myriad small and big ways in which we use our power. And I think it's up to us to identify how best to use that power. Because sometimes, the story of the person, I think, who kept throwing, who is it? The starfish. The starfish into the water. Somebody said, but you know, what are you doing? It's like, it makes a difference to the starfish. So I think the issue is, it's easy to be overwhelmed by the extent of change that is required. I think that the issue is, what are the little things that can be done? Because it is those little things that are done that begin to grow into big things as well. It's not just the big things. So it's power at a whole range of levels. About love. Love is not premised on position or status or wealth. It isn't dependent on any of that, and that is the power of love. So it's not dependent on any of those things to be able to shift, to use your power. So the question is also about if you take Obama, and I want to just shift it to him for a moment. There was a massive campaign across the United States of America in terms of the war against Iraq, and there was a very strong push for a different world, not just a different United States, that brought him into power. The question, though, is that when you put individuals, any individual, into any institution, unless you accompany putting an individual into power with institutional transformation, changing the priorities and the values of the institution itself, you will not see the kinds of changes required. So the issue is that campaign that puts an individual into power, which mobilizes the power of ordinary individuals across an entire country. How do those individuals remain mobilized once that individual they put into power is in power to sustain the shift against what is effectively an industrial military complex which goes into Iraq or Afghanistan or any other part of the world to protect the interests of its corporations? So I think that the question of how does an individual going into institutions affect power, I think that can happen. It has happened where there is continuous claiming of leadership by the millions of people who put that individual into power. So yes, I think it can, if that answers the question.
Hi, my name is Carol. We know that there was a lot of corruption before the article, but we also know that there is still a lot of corruption now.
Absolutely.
Now, how do we as individuals fight against that kind of corruption and hold people in those positions, in municipalities, doesn't matter where, but how do we hold them accountable and make this transformation at higher levels?
There's many ways of doing that. People are able to attend meetings of their local municipalities. They should attend those meetings. People are allowed to actually get access through the Protection of Access to Information Act. You're allowed. Bad mistake there. The law that I'm actually, it falls within my portfolio, is the Promotion of Access to Information Act. And we've been having a lot of trouble and arguing and fighting against the Protection of Information Act. So but just in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act, you're allowed to get information about budgets. And in different organizations, you can actually use also organizations to get access to information. And you're able to track things. So you're also able to track things not at two levels. What is the second question?
How do you give a voice to them? There's no point in knowing
that. I think that there's a number of civil society organizations that are doing excellent work in terms of trying to actually give voice to that. And I think that for people like yourself who are interested in how do you actually give voice to it, there's opportunities to join those organizations, to put your interest and energy into making sure that they succeed. So you could do a range of things. The issue of the opposition in this particular context, when the opposition is able to actually look at the critical questions and have a difference of opinion on the central questions that I'm raising, then I think I would actually think about that. But it doesn't. So for example, on the arms deal, when it came to the vote in the defense budget vote, there was nobody from the opposition that voted against it in the defense budget vote itself. There was nobody from the ANC, and nobody from the opposition. When it comes to the Medicines Control Act, for example, another example, the issue of health care, affordable health care around HIV and AIDS. In terms of the HIV AIDS debate, the committee that I chaired in Parliament, the Committee on Women, had held hearings, public hearings, during the time of the denialism in the ANC that was led by the President and the Minister of Health. The committee chose to hold public hearings and it did a report on the basis of those hearings, in which it argued that you couldn't have just prevention, you had to have treatment. That you couldn't have just nutrition, you had to have medicine. And you had to have the right to be able to choose what was best for yourself. central to the issue of HIV and AIDS is the issue of affordability of medicine in terms of being able to address the massive challenge that it poses to South Africa and to the world. A key factor in affordability is the issue of patents. If medicine is patented, and if there are laws that say that you cannot produce genetic equivalents, then you're in trouble in terms of being able to provide the kind of affordable medicine that will actually reverse the problem. In terms of the Act, when it came to Parliament, the Medicines Control Act, the Medicines Control Act was about, central to it was the issue of allowing South Africa to produce or to import affordable generic equivalents. The opposition voted against that act, many of them. So the issue is, for me, the question is, how do you have principled change in South Africa that addresses the fundamental problems that exist in our country? The need for us to think not just short term, but for us to think long term, to understand why we cannot trade off enclosing toilets with anything else, or having decent housing, access to medicine, access to healthcare, access to the right to food.
We're going to have to close the session.
Certainly.
Thank you for your information.